Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and this is another Foundational Fantasy episode. My guest is Dan Harris, who I know from the Nebulugo Book Club Discord. Hey there, Dan.
Hi.
And what are we going to be talking about for Foundational Fantasy?
We're going to be talking about Mervyn Peake's Gormenghast.
Excellent. So normally, I start by kind of crowdsourcing what is fantasy. So you want to take a crack at what the genre is?
I'll do my best, yeah. I'm really not much of a genre stickler. So, you know, when people try and delineate sci-fi fantasy, like the things that make them what they are, I don't really have I don't really have a horse in that race. But I guess for me personally, fantasy is, it's when we are presenting a world that isn't our world, even if it's just slightly off from our world. It's not an attempt to be a realistic depiction of the world.
Okay.
It can be, like, there's certainly worlds that are completely fantasy, like from the ground up, but even things that are just a little bit off, like magical realism, of course, is a subgenre of fantasy, but things like that I fully include in fantasy.
Okay, perfect. And then let's talk a little bit kind of about your history as a fantasy fan. What does the genre mean to you? You know, has it been important in your life?
I actually was kind of late in becoming a fan of fantasy, and in a limited way as well. I'm not really big into epic fantasy, like the big sort of save the world stories. Guy comes up from being a peasant to being, you know, amazing hero, that sort of thing.
Right.
I don't have like a negative opinion of them exactly, but for whatever reason, that subgenre of fantasy was kind of the face of it when I was growing up, when I was learning about the genre. So I never really dived into much of fantasy. I read Tolkien. I actually liked The Hobbit a lot more than The Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I was late coming to the genre, and it was really Gormenghast itself that kind of opened that door for me, more than just the things that everybody's aware of. Like I said, Tolkien and a few of the like childhood fantasy series that you see growing up, like the Dragon Riders of Pern, I was aware of. I'd read a little bit. So I had like a little bit of familiarity, but I wasn't really into the literary side of fantasy much at all until Gormenghast. And I came to it as an adult. So it's been kind of a different path through the genre for me from there than I think most readers.
Nice. Well, let's pull on that thread a little bit about, you know, I had never heard of Mervyn Peake. I'd never heard of Gormenghast. Mm-hmm. So you want to talk just a little bit about what the series is and who Mervyn Peake is?
He was a British, I think he started out actually painting portraits.
Yeah.
He was also a poet.
Yeah.
And he conceived of Gormenghast as being a very long series that would follow the protagonist Titus Groan from birth to death. And I think he envisioned it being, you know, some very large number of volumes, but, He actually got ill with, I've read a few different sources. Some say it was Parkinson's, some say it was something similar too. But he got ill sometime after finishing the second book and while he was working on the third. So there's really only three, and the third feels pretty unfinished. I don't know if you've read that far.
I haven't.
Okay. Usually when I recommend it to people, I recommend the first two because they tell kind of a self-contained complete story. And when you get to the end of the second one, there's clearly room for the story to go on, but the conflicts that the first book sets up wrap up in the second, and you know, you can set the series aside there and it is a complete story.
Okay. I may do that just because, like you said, with this book, it does just feel like table setting for a larger series.
The first book in particular feels like it's setting up a conflict and then... Mm-hmm. And then it kind of steps away from it.
Yeah. Yeah, I had read, I think, in the introduction to the novel when I was reading it, that Mervyn Peake had started off as an illustrator and a portrait painter, and he was a poet as well, and then moved into writing and illustrated the book as well. And so that's one thing I would say. The audiobook is excellent for this, I assume, for the whole series. But you do miss out on something because the illustrations are fantastic.
The illustrations are fantastic, yes.
And so I think it was a couple weeks ago. I can't remember if I put a note on the Discord or not, but there was an ebook of the Gormenghast trilogy.
Yeah,
I think illustrated Gormenghast trilogy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you put up a link to that. It was on sale. I'm not sure if it still is or not, but
yeah, it was only a couple of bucks, and so I got it. So just so I could, you know, as I was, I listened to a large portion of this one on audio, but then I went back and flipped through it just to look at the illustrations.
Yeah,
felt like, you know, a kid looking for the pictures in the book, right?
Yeah, definitely.
So, how does Gormenghast fit into the fantasy genre?
It's kind of a weird fit. It seems to take place in a world that's definitely not ours, but it also doesn't seem to follow, like, it doesn't have a magic system or anything like that. Mm-hmm. It's not really an adventure story, at least not in the first two books. I've heard it described as a fantasy of manners, which is kind of conjures something maybe a little stuffier than it actually is, because it is a little bit stuffy, but it almost seems to be playful with that side of it. Like, it's mocking that kind of insular, that kind of stodginess.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the world of Gormenghast is not super dissimilar to our world, right? Because there's the church, there's baptism, christening, yeah. Right? And so that it definitely, if it's a secondary world, it's one that's close to ours.
It's very, very much related. And it's a little bit hard to go into without a little bit in the third book. The third book actually takes kind of a genre turn into science fiction, but it's still a very fantasy flavored science fiction. It's also a world that seems like it's built out of a kind of madness where it's like hyper fixated and there's not a lot of breadth to the scope of it, such that, like, yes, it could be our world, but I can't imagine any part of our world that is so cut off and so inwardly focused. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were times in this book, and we should talk about what the actual plot is. There were times in this where I was like, is this like The Village, the M. Night Shyamalan thing, where where there's this fantasy enclave in an actual science fiction world, or just a modern world? But yeah, let's talk a little bit about, like, give a pitch for this, why people should read it, what's it actually about?
What it's about is...
And this the first novel is Titus Groan.
Titus Groan, yeah. And it's also a little bit hard to go into without a little bit of spoilers, because there's an element to this that I think catches a lot of readers out of, like, off guard partway in. But it's not a book that is centered around one character. It's very much an ensemble cast. And it focuses on the... Well, Titus Groan is the name of what will be the protagonist in the later books. But this book is centered around his birth as the 77th Earl of Groan. And the Groan line rules over Gormenghast, which is a castle that they pretty much never leave, and a countryside around that castle.
Mm-hmm.
And they are locked completely in tradition. Like, they are as much slave to tradition as the surrounding peasants are to them. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And what we're seeing through most of this book is the day-to-day processes of that castle, the people who live there, the lives they lead, but all kind of running in this almost clockwork alongside that, like, prescribed tradition. And there's a boy who works in the kitchens named Steerpike, who is miserable and he really wants to rise above that station. And I think the driving plot thread of the novel is Steerpike trying to rise above what he views as a life that's beneath him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the interesting things I found in this novel, especially when sort of doing a little bit of reading about where the series goes, mm-hmm. is Steerpike is definitely not a good guy, but he is kind of the POV character, and yeah. So you're all kind of rooting for him as well.
Yeah, it's it And it's funny because early on, and I don't know if you had this experience with Steer Pike as well, but early on, I didn't. It was a while before I realized that he wasn't a very good guy.
Yeah, I mean, because you see that he's in this. I mean, the chef is terrible, right? And absolutely. Okay, let's talk about this. The names of the characters.
Oh yeah,
it's just a masterclass in fantasy character names.
Yes.
You know, Lord Sepulcrave is the current.
Yes.
Earl, right? And, you know, Titus is a pretty ordinary name, but Groan as a last name is kind of funny. But there's Mr. Flay and Mr. Swelter, Nanny Slag, Steer Pike, Sourdust, Prune Squalor is so great. Just the names themselves are evocative of the characters.
The names are very evocative, and it does kind of some interesting things with that, too, in that the names will kind of prime you to see a character a certain way, and sometimes it will, like, the narrative will pull the rug out under you. Like,
yes,
certain characters start off seeming one way, and their name is a big part of what informs that. And then, as the story goes on, that character will either slowly or sometimes very suddenly shift away from what you think you know about them. And it's fun, but it's also like especially on reread, I'm very aware of the names kind of setting me up to feel a certain way about a character. And then it sort of breaks away from that. Like Nanny Slag, the name seems so harsh and like unmitigating. Like there's no give to that name at all, but she's such a fragile person. Like she gives that kind of that image of being, you know, always pushing, always, you know, trying to get everything right. But she's so fragile. She's like, there's nothing slag about Nanny Slag.
You know? No. And, you know, she definitely feels her utility starting to run out, you know, when the new heir is born, and she's like, okay, now there's an opportunity for me.
Yes.
Because her current charge, Fuchsia, the Lady Fuchsia, is, you know, I don't know, 15 or 16, something like that.
Yeah. She's middle teenage years. Yeah.
Yeah, I like the way she called her my caution.
Yes.
I had to look that up, and evidently it is kind of an old term of endearment.
Mm-hmm. Fuchsia is almost like a secondary point of view character here as well. I think Steer Pike definitely is kind of the focal character, but Fuchsia is kind of the secondary viewpoint on it, I think. At least in the first book. She steps back a bit more in the second, but...
Yeah. So, yeah, the plot of the novel is, you know, the heir is born. And so it's like, what effect does this have on everything, right? What rituals need to be gone through to install him as the 79th Earl of Groan?
Yes.
And how does it affect everyone, right? Because Fuchsia is not sure she loves the idea of a baby brother at the beginning.
And Fuchsia in particular is very... She's very irrational, but it's like she almost chases down that irrationality. She doesn't have that kind of measured response at all that says, like, I know I'm being a little bit ridiculous. She doesn't have that. She just runs headlong into irrationality.
Yeah, yeah.
But I guess kind of everybody in this book does.
Yes, yes. And the politics of everything, right? Because you have the twins who are just, they were the highlight of the book for me.
The twins are they are both creepy and funny in just about equal measure.
Yes. Yeah. And these are the twin sisters of Lord Sepulcrave.
Cora and Claris.
Yeah. And they wish that they had more power, right? They're jealous of the countess, who is the mother of the heir. And they feel like she has usurped their place. And you know, it's not a happy marriage. It never shows any tenderness between the spouses at all.
No, and there doesn't seem to be much tenderness in the family in general. The Countess, one of my favorite moments with the Countess is right near the beginning after Titus is born. She sends him away and says, "I'll see him when he's seven."
Yeah, yeah, because then Nanny Slag is tasked with going to find a wet nurse.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Boy, I don't know how to talk much more about this without getting really into spoilers. So I think we should just go straight over to that. I will say, you know, in terms of thoughts, like, you can definitely tell that Mervyn Peake was a poet because the way he marshals words is incredible.
Yeah, it's a style of prose that I think some readers really bounce off of. It's very maximalist, which usually doesn't work for me. I'm not a big fan of prose that is hyper, hyper self-aware, but it, something about it works here. And especially, one of the reasons I recommended the audiobook especially is because when it's read out loud, you can really feel the rhythm of it a lot better.
Yeah.
And it's really a kind of magic in the way it's written. But I've also known quite a few people who have started to read it and are just like, I can't endure this.
Yeah. One of my favorite phrases in it, I had to search for it because I was listening to it on audio, and then I had to go back and I'm like, I got to read chapter 14. Cause I remember there being a bunch of, I started writing down passages and I wrote down most of the chapter.
Yeah.
Because it was just like one thing after another. He was talking about describing the sisters. And he says, their faces, identical to the point of indecency, were quite expressionless, as though they were the preliminary layouts for faces and were waiting for sentience to be injected.
Yes.
That's so good. Steerpike was looking at himself in the mirror and examining an insipid mustache. Which I feel like every boy goes through that phase.
Yeah, Steerpike has a little bit of that every boyness to him, but then of course goes very far off the rails. Which,
yeah,
I guess that would be the spoilers if we're going into that.
Yeah, let's go ahead and do that because I give this a recommendation. I'm definitely going to at least check out the second novel once I finish. I'm trying to get through the Hugo nominees right now.
Okay.
So. I don't have a lot of extra bandwidth, but I have a couple Audible credits, so I'll probably grab the second book.
Excellent, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So let's go straight over into spoilers and talk about Steerpike's rise, right? Because he is working in the kitchen and under the just brutal dictatorship of Swelter. Swelter's another person who I don't love. A loathsome character being fat and therefore loathsome, right? That it is possible to walk the line of he happens to be fat, but that's not what makes him loathsome.
Yes.
I think one of the worst examples of this is the Baron Harkonnen, right? There are plenty of other things about him that are loathsome. You don't need to also say that, describe him the way it does.
I think I've heard some criticism, and it's a little bit outside my personal, my personal sensitivity to the topic, but I've also heard some criticism that some of Swelter's his described mannerisms and his sort of vocal cadence is probably intended to be homosexual, and maybe using that to color the negative connotation of him as well. Like I said, when I read it, I didn't really pick up on that, but I've had a couple of people mention to me, and it is unfortunate to have both his weight and his supposed sexuality. It's never really overtly handled at all, but anything implied like that, it's unfortunate. But
On the other hand, the way he's described here it is. Swelter, as soon as he saw who it was, stopped dead, and across his face, little billows of flesh ran swiftly here and there until, as though they had determined to adhere to the same impulse, they swept up into both oceans of soft cheek, leaving between them a vacuum, a gaping segment like a slice cut from a melon. I mean, it's just excellent.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you have the description of Flay, because they're a study in contrast, right? Because Flay is this very rigid person, and he's described as very lean as well, right?
Very lean and so rigid that when he walks, the bones in his knees crack audibly like musket shots.
Yeah, so Flay stiffened, if it is possible for something already as stiff as a piece of teak to stiffen still further, and he lowered his head to the level of his clavicles and brought his shoulders up like a vulture. Right, like, it's very vivid description.
It's almost cartoonish in how vivid it is.
Yeah, very much. You can picture him as an animated character.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, with a nose like a beak, and I'm not sure it ever describes that, but that's kind of, I picture him like the, have you ever seen The Halloween Tree, the animated film from the Ray Bradbury story?
I haven't seen the animated film, though.
The kind of mysterious vampire-like character in that, that's kind of the way I pictured Flay.
There's the New Yorker magazine sort of mascot little figure. I very often picture Flay as that that guy.
Yes. Yeah, very much. So yeah, Steer Pike, he runs away essentially from the kitchen and is trying to find, does he find himself on the outside of the castle and he ends up climbing into Lady Fuchsia's little,
her attic. Yeah. It's interesting. Like when I reread the book, this is actually my third read of the book. The first reread I had of it, I had kind of the realization that Steer Pike feels to me kind of like an inversion of a Charles Dickens protagonist, where he starts off, you know, the Dickens protagonist very, very often starts off in a situation of misfortune, but has the ability to kind of rise out of it. And they're beset by, you know, all kinds of obstacles, and eventually the setbacks kind of mount up, but it is their general goodwill and the connections they make that kind of elevate them out of that. And Steer Pike is not that, but he kind of starts off seeming like that.
He does. He presents that way.
Yes. And, and it's the early part of his story. He kind of follows, when he follows Flay out of the kitchens, that's actually the segment of the novel that is most vivid in my memory. Even from my first read of it, when he's following Flay through the hallways, and he, like, the narrator describes, like, pools of light that he sees Flay moving forward into, and sort of trailing him far enough back that he's not seen. But he is eventually caught, and Flay takes him to kind of see the newly born Earl. And from the room he's locked into, Steer Pike escapes, and like I said, he climbs up onto the roofs of the castle, which are described as kind of like an architectural desert that nobody's walked through for generations. Mm-hmm. And his journey there, it even feels like kind of that heroic journey of self-discovery. Mm-hmm. And what Steer Pike finds is not very heroic.
Right. And I mean, he lands among the family and is like the, in terms of his character, he is very canny, right? He's sly as a fox, right?
Yes.
And he realizes, wow, this is a group of people that I can just manipulate the hell out of.
Absolutely, yes. He needs that sort of, he just needs that little bit of an in, that little chip in the armor to work his way into, and he finds it.
Yeah, especially when he lands on the twins, right?
Yes.
Because they are so vapid and just clueless, you know, and grasping, right? They anything that will help advance them, they're going to sign on for.
And yes, they are very predictable, but up to a point.
Right. And that's the problem, right? When you hitch your wagon to somebody who's kind of dumb, they're going to do dumb things.
Yes. And there's not much in the book that's dumber than Cora and Clarice, but they're strangely endearing. Like they're kind of repulsive and endearing in equal measure as well.
Mm-hmm. Lord Sepulcrave is an interesting character because he's very fragile, and you know he's unhappy and melancholic kind of. But the one thing that kind of keeps him from just losing it is his library.
Yeah, his library is what holds him together.
Yeah. And Steer Pike realizes this at some point and sets about to, okay, here is how we get you to your proper recognition. We just have to pull the rug out from Sepulcrave. He'll go nuts and the world will be your oyster.
Yes. And in a way that works.
Yes.
And in fact, I think it works better than he planned because the current master of tradition, I forget what the actual title they gave him was, but the guy whose job it is, Sourdust is the character's name. Mm-hmm. His job is to read the books of tradition and interpret them to know day to day, like every day, this is the plan for the day. This is what is ordained to be our ritual. Master of Ritual, I think is what it was.
Yeah, I think that is what it's called.
That's Sourdust's job. And when Steer Pike sets out on his plan to burn down the library, I don't think he planned for it this way, but it winds up being the death of Sourdust.
Yes.
So there's a gap in the structure of the castle. The Master of Ritual is gone. They need a new one. And Steerpike doesn't step into that role at this point, but with Sourdust's heir taking it on, Steerpike kind of has that opening to step in and have that influence, at least some influence.
Yeah. Another character we haven't, I think we mentioned his name, Dr. Prunesqualler.
Yeah.
You know, sorry, I mean, Dr. Prunesqualler.
Yes. Prunesqualler is another character that is a favorite of mine in that the first impressions frame him to be something very, very obnoxious. And yes, he is obnoxious, but there's also kind of a kindness to him that you kind of reluctantly come to realize. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because he's, you know, you can almost see him as the opposite of people like Cora and Claris, right? Because he is not really out for his own self-aggrandizement. He kind of is actually caring for the people under his care.
Yes. But he also has that affect, that laugh, that it makes it seem like he's never taking anyone quite seriously, even himself. Which is not really the quality you want from a doctor, but he does seem to care. It's a strange mix of features, but that's kind of what makes this book tick, is mixing strange features and then seeing where they go.
Yeah. Yeah. And so there's more than one thread in the novel, because you have the through line of Steerpike's rise, right?
Yes.
But you also have the growing grudge between Flay and Swelter.
Yes.
Which it's interesting, because it might have gone a different direction had Flay not been ousted from the castle by Lady Gertrude, because Lady Gertrude is not fond of people, but she loves animals and birds. And yes. I think, doesn't Flay throw a cat at someone?
He throws it at Steerpike. Yeah.
At Steerpike. That's right.
Steerpike is kind of goading him into losing his cool, and Flay does lose his cool and throws a cat at him, and Gertrude will not stand for that.
No, she won't. So she puts him out of the castle, and he finds that he is pretty content out in the woods, but also still has the beef with Swelter. And I think, I can't remember precisely what precipitated the antipathy. I think it had been growing for years and years.
It seems to be something that's kind of baked into both of their characters, where Flay tolerates Swelter, but absolutely loathes him, and Swelter kind of eggs him on a little bit with kind of mocking him sort of playfully, that sense of I can get you angry, you know?
Yeah, which works, because then Flay takes a swipe at him, right? I think he hits him with a chain or something.
Yeah, and embarrasses Swelter in front of his boys.
Yeah, and so he more or less just, you know, vows revenge, and he's kind of slowly plotting to come and do a sling blade thing in the middle of the night to him.
Yes, and the scene when Flay realizes that this is happening is another scene that plays out very cartoonishly in my mind, and it's almost horror, except that it's so cartoonish, where he sees Flay going through the motions of practicing sneaking up on somebody and killing them in their sleep.
With a cleaver, yeah.
With a cleaver, yes.
A Swelter, not Flay, yeah.
Oh, Flay watches him do it, though. Sorry, I might have misspoke. But Swelter goes through the motions of taking his cleaver and sneaking up on somebody and killing them in their sleep. And Flay realizes that that's meant for him.
Yeah.
And vows to sort of protect himself from that.
Mm-hmm. One thing from watching, you know, period dramas where looking at the hierarchy of everything, right? The chef is quite important and the valet is quite important, but there doesn't seem to be a butler who would mediate between them.
Yeah, that doesn't seem to be a role that is part of the Gormenghast hierarchy. I kind of see Flay as being in that position as much as anyone else is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I feel like they both have their little fiefdoms, and they feel, well, I'm more important.
Yes.
And that's part of the antipathy.
I think so, yeah.
And of course, you know, this all eventually comes to a head where they actually have a battle, and it's quite interesting to read, right? Quite exciting.
Yes.
Even though it's kind of in slow motion as well.
Yeah. And it's, again, like, it's so bizarre that it's hard to imagine it as a piece of physical reality. It's almost slapstick, except that it's lethal slapstick.
Right.
with Swelter at one point, like holding his cleaver and spinning around in this, like this whirlwind of blades, which is so funny to imagine, but is still very engaging to read.
Yeah. Yeah. And it seemed like, I don't know, at some point in the whole thing, you'd think both of them would go, okay, this is stupid, right?
Yeah.
But they don't.
No, moderation doesn't seem to be a quality in Gormenghast.
Yeah. There's, I can't remember if it was the christening or if it was the breakfast. There's one chapter that is really uniquely told because it switches between the experiences of all the major characters.
Oh, yeah, I believe that was the christening when every character like around the table sort of has that same moment that it shifts between every view.
Everybody's interior monologue.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was, I'm pretty sure that was the christening.
I thought there was some ceremonial meal.
Yeah, it's after Titus is born, when he's placed in the book, it was that one, I think. But yeah, I know exactly which scene you mean. And somebody passes out and you have so many different perspectives of their head thunking down on the table.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, we mentioned earlier that this definitely feels like a table setting book. But it's enough of a self-contained story of kind of Steerpike's rise and Titus being going through all the rituals to actually become the Earl.
Yeah, it's stage setting in a lot of ways, but yeah, the Steerpikes sort of rise up out of the kitchens, and then Flay is kind of not exactly a downfall, but in a way a downfall. Like it's that kind of juxtaposition is, I think, the heart of the book. And you touched on it a bit earlier. You mentioned about Flay leaving the castle and kind of finding a measure of happiness outside in the wilderness. That's actually a moment in it that I really, really like, because early on, there's a chapter we have that's very Flay focused, where it mentions that he's on the lookout for any kind of joy or happiness in anybody, because to him, that is a sign of rebellion. Gormenghast is such a somber place that anyone being happy has to be up to something, right? And he can't abide rebellion. And after he's cast out and he's in the wilderness and he's walking around, he finds himself really contented. And he has this moment where he thinks to himself, is this rebellion? And I love that. I love that moment when Flay has lost everything that was important to him, everything that was his identity. He's has been stripped from him at this point, and he realizes he's happy. And it is such a contrast to Steerpike, who is desperately trying to grab that. He's trying to grab a hold of that tradition, that, you know, he's trying to gain that identity that Flay wasn't trying to shed off, but now has found that he appreciates having shed off. Like the two characters are on opposite tracks, and each is sort of gaining, like Steerpike thinks he's gaining, Flay thinks he's losing. And Flay kind of realizes that he hasn't lost. He's gained something new, which maybe is it's maybe foreshadowing something of Steerpike, not so directly, but it definitely takes Steerpike's accomplishments and puts them in a different light.
Yeah, and I was going to say that Steerpike, you know, I think he thinks if he gets over that next rung, that's where he's going to be content.
Yes.
And I don't think he's self-aware enough to know there's never going to be enough rungs.
Yes. He's very, he's ambitious almost as compulsion.
One of the, we mentioned, right, if you hatch your plans with dumb people, they're going to do dumb things, right? And so
yes. He
sets up to set the library on fire and then make himself the hero rescuing everyone from the fire.
Yes.
But he doesn't realize, of course, that the twins are really dumb, and they several times try and spill the beans.
Yes.
about it. And his solution to that is unique.
Yeah, his solution is to cut them off from everybody and kind of terrify them into thinking that a spirit is after them.
Yes. And if they speak of it, then they're in trouble.
Yes. And it works, but it also doesn't, it feels like a half measure. It feels like the sort of thing that, you know, that's not going to be the end of it.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. If you learn anything from Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, it's the conspirators who survive are the ones who are the only ones who survive.
Yes. And, it's funny you mentioned TV shows as comparison. When you were talking about, Steer Pike never having enough rungs, I was thinking of actually Don Draper from Mad Men, where, you know, you can have everything and it's never going to be enough to satisfy.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking of Flay, like Kendall from Succession. I don't know if you've seen that show, but constantly grasping at trying to take over this media empire, right? And then I won't spoil it.
Okay.
So much of watching that show was like, are you sure that this job is what you want? You know, wouldn't you be happier taking the $2 billion buyout and going and doing your own thing?
Yeah.
Yeah. But ambitions, you know, they're killer.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're a killer, not only of oneself, but of the people around you too, it turns out.
Big time. Yeah. Oh, I found another quote that I loved that was talking about Sepulcrave. Said, no doubt the unsatisfactory marriage had added to his native depression, but compared with the dull forest of his inherent melancholy, it was but a tree from a foreign region that had been transplanted and absorbed.
Yeah.
So good.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the book is full of like little quotes and observations like that, that are both dark and kind of that kind of foreboding heaviness to them, mm-hmm. but also some that are just downright funny. Like Peake has a bizarre sense of humor that really works. There's one during the crowning when Titus towards the end of the novel is being lifted up to the rank of Earl. Mm-hmm. And he's on the, like they have him on the raft and he's supposed to hold up, you know, two things as the symbols of his position. But because he's a baby. I mean, he's 1 year old. They can't really instruct him on the right way to do it. And at that point, I think it's Barkentine, the replacement master of ritual, remarks something like, it's almost like the child has a will of his own.
Yes. Yeah. He just drops the stuff into the lake, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think so. But it's he drops stuff, but he's also... He strikes such a figure that it carries it off anyway. Everybody's impressed by it, even though it's not precisely what he's supposed to have done. And that's one thing that maybe we should mention is that this book covers pretty much the span of time from Titus's birth to about 1 year of age. Titus is the title character. But he's not much of a character in this one. He's much more of the instigating action.
Yeah, he's the MacGuffin for the action of the entire book.
Yes.
And then the second book takes place over a longer period of time, or is there a time gap?
There's a time gap. It picks up, I believe, when Titus is 7 years old, and then covers a longer time as well. I believe it ends when I'm not sure if he's 17. Like that's the age that I have in my head, but I know it's like late teenager when it ends.
Okay. Nice. Yeah. It's fascinating to have the title character be someone you don't get to know at all because they're a baby.
he's much more of the focal character of the second book. Many of the same characters are still around, of course. Not a lot changes in Gormenghast until it does change. That's another thing that I kind of wanted to touch on with Steer Pike as well is, and you don't see it as much in this first book, and I'm not going to go too far into spoilers with the second book because obviously you haven't read it, and I presumably some of your listeners haven't as well. But with Steer Pike specifically, he's not a good guy, but the sort of strict, oppressive, like that ritual ceremony aspect of Gormenghast is really not a healthy situation either. Like that absolute reliance on tradition is so strangling to everybody in the castle. Like everybody's miserable because of it. mm-hmm. and nobody can quite get out of it. And as awful as Steerpike is, and he is, like, there's not really any finagling around that. Steerpike is terrible, but he's also, in kind of a strange way, he's that push that it needs to kind of start wearing away at that rigid tradition. It's not through any kindness on his part, but it is what kind of makes the difference. It's the fulcrum.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I can't fault him for having ambitions beyond working in the kitchens, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And so there's any number of places, especially when he just sort of befriends Fuchsia, you know, he could have risen to a slightly better servant rank.
Yes.
I also can't really fault him for going, well, what if I could do better than that? You know?
Yeah.
It's just he's not the kind of person to be able to find a contented level.
Well, and he's not... He seems to me to be very much a kind of sociopath as well. And it's not immediately obvious because early on, he's looking out for himself, but the frame of the story is, you know, of course he's looking out for himself. Nobody else is looking out for him. So it's you're kind of on his side following him, you know, through his path until, like, at certain points, it stumbles a little bit and you go, wait a minute, and... Shortly after he meets Fuchsia is the first, when I was reading it the first time, was the first kind of wait a minute moment for me, because he meets Fuchsia and, you know, it, knowing nothing about this book, you kind of, or at least I kind of, anticipated a kind of, star-crossed lovers sort of thing where, you know, they can't be together, but yeah, you know, and I sort of imagine this story taking shape in my head. And of course, that's not where it goes, but you can kind of see that that's the story taking shape in Steerpike's head as well, not because he has any fondness for Fuchsia, but because that might be a way for him to rise up. Mm-hmm. And he comes across as really manipulative really quickly. And it's like, wait a minute, you know, hold up. And it's at every step past that, he goes that little bit further than seems reasonable.
Yeah. Yeah.
Until finally he's reaching a point where obviously this is not a very good person. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the one comparison that I make to people usually after they've read it, but not before because obviously spoilers, is to Patricia Highsmith's Talented Mr. Ripley.
Mm.
Steerpike isn't exactly like Tom Ripley in those books, but there's a thread of it that's similar in that you see him struggle. So the book kind of it kind of wins you over to his side early on,
right?
And it's almost playful with seeing how far it can keep you on his side,
right? Right. I bought that book a year and a half or so ago. I've got it on my shelf downstairs. I'm like, I really want to read that.
It's something strange and special.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's always a trick that you know movies and books can play, where they're like, hey, here's a bad guy. And here's all the awful people around him. I'm going to have you root for the first bad guy.
Yeah. Or even have you root for a bad guy that's, even if he's not surrounded by entirely awful people.
Yeah.
But there's kind of a magic trick to it where it will show you how awful he is, but also show you some kind of vulnerability that makes you not want to leave off rooting for them.
Mm-hmm. Hey, when was when did this first book come out? Was it the 60s?
I believe, I think the first one was in the 30s, the late 30s.
Okay.
I don't know the publication dates for the later ones. I know it was, the first one came out after The Hobbit, but before The Lord of the Rings was published.
Okay. Looks like 46.
Oh, 46. Okay, that's later than I was thinking, but not by a whole lot. But yeah, it's... I've heard a few discussions about the book from fans of it, like along the lines of, you know, how would the fantasy genre be different if this was the book that kind of blew it up versus Tolkien? And I don't think it quite works, just because, I mean, Tolkien was always going to be the fan favorite. Like that style of story is always going to win people over more than this style of story is. Mm-hmm. I like Gormenghast better than Tolkien, but it's never going to be that It's never going to be that fan favorite. But it is interesting to think about how the fantasy genre is, like, because the works that are influenced by this more than Tolkien definitely have kind of a different flavor to them.
Hmm. How did you come to this one the first time? I don't think
we've I had a friend actually who recommended it to me, and she's a friend who, she has an annoying habit of recommending the perfect book, and I always wind up putting it off. And the thing is, I know I'm going to like it when she recommends it, but I put it off because I think, oh, you know, I can get to it later. I have all these other things I want to read, and I think I kind of know what the shape of that book is going to be. And then eventually I come to it and it's like, oh, I should have read this years ago, you know? And it's,
yeah,
it's very rude of her to do that to me over and over again.
Yeah, it's definitely her fault.
Absolutely, of course. It's not my stubbornness.
My feeling is when somebody recommends me a book, if I read it and I bounce off it, I feel kind of bad.
Yeah.
And so that's lots of times why I put things off.
That's definitely part of it, where you want a little bit of space from their enthusiasm before you jump into something.
Yeah.
But again, like it's been so many times that she's recommended something and it's like, oh God, this is perfect, that I really need to learn to just listen and maybe someday.
Yeah. Well, anything else we should talk about Titus Groan or Gormenghast?
I think we've covered the first two books pretty well.
Okay.
I think the third book is kind of a, and this is one thing I think people should be aware of. Like, I think a lot of people avoid the series because it is famously unfinished. It's only two books out of however many it was planned to be. But like I said early on, those first two books do tell a complete story. The third book feels, in the context of there only being three of them, it feels a little bit unfinished. The prose isn't as polished. It feels like there's some gaps in it, but mostly it feels kind of like, you know, the further adventures of versus being part of a larger, grander story. The first two books kind of are that story that builds and completes, and then it moves on to something else. And I like the third book a lot, but it's harder to recommend it.
Okay. All right. I think that's probably a good place to leave it. So I want to say thank you for bringing up something I had no idea about. And I love the fact that this is, like, for foundational fantasy, it's fun to do something from way back in the day.
Yes. And it's foundational in a big way as well, because there are a lot of modern authors that are very inspired by Mervyn Peake. Gene Wolfe has listed him as an inspiration, which if you've read Book of the New Sun, I'm sure you can see some similarities in the tone. China Mieville has listed as an inspiration. So there's definitely stuff out there that is building on the foundation that Gormenghast laid a number of years ago.
Mm.
But it's a very different flavor of fantasy from most of what we see in the genre.
Okay, cool.
Oh, I actually meant to ask, I'm sure you haven't seen it, but have you come across anything about the BBC TV adaptation of Gormenghast?
I just saw it on, I saw it referenced on the Wikipedia page.
It's, I can't really recommend it. It's a close adaptation in some fun ways. And, you know, Christopher Lee as Flay is actually a really inspired casting choice. And I think the twins are both fantastic in it as well. But it's aesthetically such a departure that it feels very, it doesn't feel like a very good fit to me. But it's maybe something, like an interesting oddity to look into. I wouldn't say it was bad. It just is a very strange take on the aesthetic.
Mm. Well, that's often the case with, I mean, I don't know about 2000s era, because, like, you know, 80s era BBC stuff, I'm like, what can we do on a soundstage? You know, and, you know, with very limited external shots. I think of the Day of the Triffids adaptation.
Yeah. Well, and part of the early 2000s, like part of what makes the aesthetic a little bit strange is that it's very early CGI for a lot of the castle shots and stuff like that. And it looks a little strange, but also the color palette of it is not at all what I envisioned when I read the book.
Well, all the illustrations are black and white. So,
well, the illustrations are black and white, but even the descriptions, when it mentions color, it's usually like muted tones. It's a very kind of grayscale book in my head.
Okay.
And the TV series is extremely colorful. Much more than what you would probably guess. It's a strange juxtaposition, but in terms of plot, it follows the first two books pretty closely.
Excellent. All right. Well, before we sign off, you got any place people can find you?
I'm in the process of establishing a little blog on Substack, The Strangest Roads Substack. My reasoning for the name is that I always think of fiction as kind of the mile we can walk in somebody else's shoes. And sci-fi and fantasy provides us with the weirdest, the strangest roads we can walk on. And there's not much to it yet, but I'm kind of working on it.
All right. Send me a link to it and I can put it in the show notes. So.
Excellent.
All right, Dan, thanks for joining me again. I didn't mention at the top that you were on for the science fiction and fantasy concepts draft a while back.
But it's good to have you back. It's good to be back. Thanks for having me.
Yep. All right. Take care. Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed that discussion. It's definitely an interesting novel. It's a series that I'm going to check out the rest of at some point. I've really been enjoying this foundational fantasy journey that I'm on. As always, I need more guests. So if you are somebody who wants to do a foundational fantasy episode, reach out to me. If you want to do a regular episode, find a book off the list and send me a pitch for what you want to do. Reach out to me, feedback@hugospodcast.com. As usual, all the links are in the show notes for if you want to support the podcast. I am in the midst of reading all the Hugo-nominated novels. I'm going to be doing a guest appearance on another podcast for those. I will probably host something for short stories, at least, maybe novelettes. So if you want to be on one of those panels, then go ahead and reach out to me and I will start thinking about setting those up. I do want to remind you that I do have another podcast. So if you like hearing from me, you might also enjoy Take Me to Your Reader, where we discuss adapted science fiction. It's a lot of fun. We've covered a lot of really classic movies and lots of titles that people probably didn't know were adapted from books. There's a lot of more modern projects like Project Hail Mary that, you know, obviously people know about. There's lots of more obscure stuff. So if you want to check that out, it doesn't get as many views or downloads as Hugo's, but we've been doing Take Me to Your Reader since 2014. And check it out. The website is pavementpodcast.com for reasons I won't get into here, but you can just find it as Take Me to Your Reader on any podcast platform. Okay, I think that's going to do it. For this time, thanks so much for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye.
The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kusky.